Welcome to the Healthy Podcast, where we invite you to invest in your well-being and unlock the secrets of vibrant health, peak performance, and wellness. Join us, Sebastian Mirau and Johannes Kettelhout, co-founders of Australia and New Zealand's leading wellness company, as we dive deep into the science, strategies, and stories that empower you to live your healthiest, happiest life. Whether you are a CEO, high achiever, entrepreneur, elite athlete, health enthusiast, scientist, or self-improvement seeker, together we will explore the cutting edge of biohacking techniques and holistic health practices with world-class experts that optimize your mind, body, and spirit. With each episode, you will walk away with practical and actionable steps to integrate in your daily life. Are you ready? Let's elevate your well-being.
Welcome on the show, Josh. We got quite a few different topics that we can talk about, but you know, I'm really, really stoked to see, you know, your path of starting off in sort of more the finance and more the conventional industries that are out there, and then going all the way to psychedelics, biohacking, which is really cutting edge of looking at so many different health modalities and taking it to the next level. And to me, often it means also quantifying, actually. Like, I don't know, when I first got in touch with a lot of these health topics, that was in the 90s when I was sort of like, I guess, a teenager, there was a lot of guesswork of like, I think this helps. I think this is a good modality and you should eat more of this and so on. But I think what we're really fortunate is that 20 years down the track from them, you know, we can quantify actually what are the results in doing that. And also having done some experimentation with certain foods and realizing this is no good. You know, like when you go into, certain supplements that, you know, actually completely throw you off. So I'm an absolute cacao chocolate junkie, but you know, that there's a price to pay if you do it really unbalanced. Before you know it, your thyroids are completely burned out and things like that. You know, where you think, what can chocolate do to you that, you know, other than maybe gaining some weight? But you know, there's much more to it. But because we also realize a lot of these health foods are super powerful, and therefore also, you know, you need to know what you're actually doing.
Yeah, just because something's natural doesn't make it, just because something's natural doesn't make it safe, or doesn't mean you have to neglect things like cofactors. Like everyone's like, oh, you know, like we can just like throw in a bunch of vitamins because it's like B1 without realizing you're depleting B2 and potassium and magnesium. So yeah, I think the natural thing can really throw people off and then go all ass to grasp. And these things, a lot of people forget that pharmaceuticals are derived from plants, you know.
It's a real conundrum, isn't it? I mean, when you look at you know, sort of all the natural supplements, the food that also have co-benefits for you, when you look at that, what would you say, your experience, like, how do you actually know what's right and wrong for you? Because doctors often are not cutting edge and would not really know what else is there that they could use or how to use it. But then you experiment on yourself, which we don't necessarily want to do either.
Yeah. So there's a couple of ways that I'd answer that. The first is, obviously, with the growth of functional and integrative medicine, we can actually test for certain micronutrient deficiencies. So there is a test called the NutriVal, which is a pretty thorough test that looks at all sorts of energy metabolism, carbohydrate metabolism profiles and Krebs cycle stuff, but also just gives you like a breakdown in whether or not, or an aggregated score to see whether or not you are deficient in vitamin C, vitamin A, vitamin E, amino acids. Do you have any predisposition to gut dysbiosis? So there are functional medicine tests that, and NutriVal is a blood test, that can help diagnose where you might be lacking. I mean, they're not perfect, but they're pretty good. So I would say if you really want to know what to do, you would test to see where you're deficient in. Now, the problem with that is that this is going to be always this like balance between quantification and like quantifying things and then the more like qualitative side of things. So I bet we've all had this experience, but we see a piece of data on a sheet and we're like, therefore I need X, and then you take X and you feel crap. So there's this like gentle balance between the masculine and the feminine, between the mind and the felt sense, whereby like we need to use data to guide us, but it's not also the be all and end all because we can't measure everything. You know, there's going to be all these like interaction effects because the body's a complex system that are doing things that science just hasn't modeled yet. So we don't understand how they all interact. Yeah. So I'd say, yeah, if you really want to know, start with testing like something like a Nutrival. And then the second thing is really just like discerning through interoceptive senses, like when do I feel tired after eating? When do I feel alive after eating? And you can sort of like track those markers sort of more viscerally. So that's how I try to do it. I try to test and I try to feel, and I'm still not perfect.
Yeah. No, that's right. And if you want some guidance for a practitioner, what type of practitioner would we look for to find, or what type of doctor? Because you're so right. I'm so with you. Like some people take a lot of vitamin C, but forget that there's also a fluon effect on your iron levels. So, you know, like there's just certain things that happen in your body. It's the same as vitamin D doesn't just work. You have to have, you know, other things in your bodies to be actually absorbed and so on. So like, where do you get this education from? Is it something... Yeah, do you have some views on it? How you get guided by someone that actually understands what they're doing?
Well, I've sort of been in a bit of a journey with this because I used to supplement a lot and then I stopped supplementing at all. And now I take like two or three supplements. I take like L-theanine and magnesium glycinate before bed, and that's pretty much it. Because if you take whole food sources, then nature and evolution has figured out how all these things work together, how minerals and vitamins, and you know, you're not going to overdose from vitamin C by eating a grapefruit. You know, the proportions are perfect. We've co-evolved with these plants. So I think whole foods are a one way to avoid that. But the problem is, in a modern toxic world, we do tend to be more deficient in certain vitamins and minerals. So for example, magnesium, I mean, you know, the vast majority of United States adults are deficient in magnesium. Why? Well, topsoil depletion, fertilizers, pesticides, herbicides, these all deplete soil nutrient quality. And so even if you are eating a whole food diet, you still might be deficient because of what industry and agriculture has done to soil and therefore to the quality of ingredients and plants. So the way I sort of do two things, I like geek out a little bit and like really try to learn for myself these sort of interactions. And that's obviously flawed because I can't know everything. You know, it's not my, I'm not doing a PhD in nutrition yet. I do think there are some like really good functional medicine practitioners out there who really get this stuff. I think if your gut is well and you're eating healthy and you can track your micronutrient intake through something like the chronometer, which can track your micronutrients, you're going to be able to track what am I actually getting from my food supply. And a lot of people use the chronometer, which is an app. And a lot of people who I speak to, they're like, oh yeah, I don't get enough magnesium and I don't get enough potassium. Those seem to be the two big glaring things.
Yeah, well, can you measure your magnesium level in the body?
Yes, you can make it. So the chronometer measures the micronutrients that you're eating from your food. And then you can do serum magnesium tests, like serum blood magnesium tests. They're not wholly accurate. And then you can do things like the Nutrival, which sort of show approximations of underlying minerals. But again, a lot of this is testing and like what time of day is it? And just because you have like an excess or deficiency of thing in the blood, does that mean there's an excess or deficiency in the cells? You know, it's very hard to track.
Gotcha. So what was your approach to actually create a diet that works for you? Because I think that's like, they're often, especially in the health scene, we're all foodies, it seems, and we love certain things. But at the same time, I found that there's certain foods that are really good for me, but they're not necessarily the foods that really excite me. Like, how did you find sort of that balance or the relationship to your food that works actually from a nutrient point of view, that you eat the right thing?
I've tried most diets, keto, carnivore, veggie. I've never gone vegan. And I just realized, like, I just feel better eating like a decent amount of meat, and I've sort of let go of a lot of the perfectionism stuff, because I'd find that, you know, this is a bit of a cliche, but if I tried to get really dogmatic about food intake, I ended up causing more stress, and that stress then, you know, has impact on gut motility, and so your gut doesn't absorb things as well. And so I'm sort of more of like an 80-20 guy at the moment. So 80% good stuff, 20% I sort of do what I want, and I actually feel better that way because I have less of a rebound effect. I don't know if this is the same for you, but like, I don't have these like 3 month sprints of like fast, like doing like one fast a week and then keto, and then I just blow up. Then I'm just like, then I binge for a month. And there's like, nature has this way, or like the psyche has this way of like establishing balance, whether you like it or not. So whether it's a lack of willpower on my behalf, I don't know, but I find it better to eat sort of moderately.
Yeah, I agree with that. And, you know, I used to go all in on raw veganism for years. And that's a very dogmatic, because you basically say, I don't eat any processed food or drink any processed water. Like, I just do exactly raw. And the conversation is normally, are you at 98%? Or, you know, are you more like the 100% guy? Or are you 90? Like, you know, whatever it is. And what it produces is like guilt whenever you're not 100% on it. And that guilt is pretty bad. Like in my extreme times, I would probably beat myself up for the rest of the day. It's like, I really felt like, I don't know. I mean, it wouldn't have been even bad, but something that was like bread, you know, suddenly I'd take, you know, have a piece of bread, or, you know, being German, like, you know, the good German roll, and had one of those sandwiches. It's like, oh my God, like what just happened? And, you know, and really soul searching of how could that be that I needed to eat this, or that I wasn't strong enough to stay what's really healthy for me. And maybe you have to go through these phases, I don't know. But it's certainly, I can see how much stress it causes. And when I see people who are really, really good in their diet, there's not much joy there often, because it's a fight against maybe also the urge of like, I want this. And yeah.
I also wonder if it's just like, you know, like in a lot of religions, they have, you know, like in asceticism, there's like a sense of like punishment. Like, I do wonder, like, as I started to deconstruct like certain like psychological like dispositions, like push at all costs, a lot of the extremism that was coming into my dietary habits also sort of went away. You know, like there was like a pressure that I was playing out in myself, and one way that it expressed itself was being really rigid with what I ate. It never got bad, but it was just like, it wasn't sustainable. Just diet, fat, like go off into the woods and fast. And I mean, that's great, right? Like fasting's great. God, I don't think you need to be extreme to be healthy. I think to be healthy is to be whole to some degree. And wholeness means, you know, your mind-body relationships or environment are sort of working in some sort of decent harmony with each other, not just overextended on the nutrition or the biological front.
What are your views on this balance between the three? Like, what have you seen, sort of like the emerging tools that are out there, or already established tools that you believe sort of balance that out to the degree that people really feel grounded, feel good in themselves, and, you know, find a sustainable sort of state for themselves?
Yeah. So I'll introduce something that we use at Holon, which is a wellness center that I'm about to start in Scotland. And it's, we have this like philosophy or this model, which is very simple, which is that in order for people to move towards health, and that's health, that is physical health, mental health, emotional health, spiritual health, relational health. There's sort of three core components. The first is removing bad stuff, or reducing the negative load on the body, whether that's through toxins, like everything from, you know, the fertilizers and pesticides that I spoke about before. Maybe it's blue light, maybe it's, you know, processed food, maybe it's EMFs. You know, how people feel about EMFs, you know, some people say they're totally harmless because of non-ionizing radiation. Other people say no, there's actually like effects through this thing called quantum tunneling. But anyway, I think it's clear that the world is extremely toxic. And one of the stats that I love to talk about is that there was an inventory released by a few researchers a couple of years back, and they measured how many toxins have been released into the atmosphere since 1950. And they showed that 350,000 toxins have been released through industry and agriculture over the last 70 years. And the crazy thing is we have safety studies on about 50,000 of them. What does that mean? It means there's 300,000 chemicals that we're breathing, we're eating, we're drinking. And yeah, they might be molecularly similar to each other. Therefore, you can make a claim that one is safe because another has been proven as safe. But let's take the example of lead. There was a Duke University study from 2022, and they estimated what was the impact of lead, you know, like lead from gas and petrol before it was outlawed. And it was something like 170 million Americans lost almost a billion IQ points whilst lead was in the atmosphere. And that's just one toxin.
Yes.
Yeah. And I can send you these links after. The idea is, and then you have things like forever chemicals like PFAS. The idea is that there is so much toxicity in the environment that it is putting a big strain on the human organism. And so one way I think we can come to health is like this pillar one is removing or reducing this toxic burden on our systems. The second pillar is adding good stuff. Let's remove the bad, but add the good. And what is good? Good is the things like micronutrients, like we were speaking about, Sebastian, is light. You know, you'll know this better than anyone. Like, light has a profound impact on human biology. And we are totally deficient in, you know, light sources. And, you know, there's near infrared, there's red. But, you know, UVA has some positive impact. It's not all bad, as is UVB. It's not just vitamin D synthesis, but there's like beta endorphins. And you throw someone into the sunshine between 12 and 4 in a sunny climate, and suddenly, you know, a lot of people's moods start to lift. It's like, okay, interesting. Like, maybe it's not all bad being exposed to the sunshine. So there's good things that I think we're deficient in modern civilization. There's micronutrients, there's light, but then there's also these deeper sort of more like soulful elements like meaning and a connection to the sacred, a connection to each other, a connection to nature. And I think a lot of us are deficient in that too. So that would be my second pillar. Like, what do you do to come into wholeness, both physically, mentally, emotionally, spiritually? You remove the bad, you start adding the good. And then the third pillar is what we'd call just balancing the body and mind. You know, what is your nervous system like? You know, are you giving it enough hermetic stress? Are you giving it enough deep relaxation and peace? Are you, you know, looking at some of your developmental drama patterns and realizing why you act out the way you do? So those would be my like three kind of like simple but quite complex pillars: remove the bad, add the good, and balance the nervous system. And I think when you can sort of take that viewpoint into health, you might solve a lot of the issues that are underlying.
Yeah. And to me, that means that there's a middle path between, you know, doing it what we did in the past, like hundreds of years ago, which was probably being way more exposed to sunlight, being, you know, in nature just by default, because we didn't have as many buildings. But when we were in our shelters, we probably wouldn't have artificial light, which meant we had quite a natural rhythm of waking and sleeping and that type of thing. And I know on the same time, it also gets romanticized in a way. It's like everything was better. And of course that wasn't, because, you know, there is actually a lot of, like, you know, you start with hygiene and you go into sort of like what the medical field has to offer, especially if it's emergency, but also other insights that science really gave us that we wouldn't have known and we wouldn't have been exposed to in the olden days, where, you know, technology wasn't there to help us. But something in particular that I wanted to talk to you about is, like, you know, psychedelics, I think, have always been part of society for, I don't know, as long probably as humans been around. But I guess, you know, after the 70s, there was certainly a drop off of that and what, you know, from my point of view, at least I've seen that. And this has come strongly back and has been also said to, like, it's way safer than we actually thought if used correctly. You've dove into that topic a little bit, right?
Yeah, I've hosted a couple of conferences on, like, the science of these new tools or these old tools. And yeah, I think they're quite promising molecules for mental health. I don't think they're the be all and end all. I think you have a lot of psychedelic aficionados who think they're going to change the world. I don't think that's the case. But I think, yeah, for people who are struggling with things like treatment resistant depression, they've definitely got, like, a potential clinical benefit. And, you know, there's probably other benefits beyond solving negative mental states. I think, you know, I know of some companies who are using it for, you know, skin issues. And I think part of it is by, like, resetting the brain back to its, like, factory settings for some time, the body is able to, you know, well, the brain is able to sort of recalibrate and reset. It's a field that I was interested in when I was living in San Francisco, especially the science of this stuff, but it's not something that's taking up so much of my mental space at the moment.
Fair enough. Fair enough. You did work in neuro spirituality. What exactly does that mean? Because that's probably what you were, while you were in the States, I think that was something that you were working on as well. I found that really fascinating. In fact, I've never heard about that field.
Yeah, not many people have. So a few years ago, I was at Harvard in the States, and I was doing some grad work in human development, which is basically the science of, like, how humans develop. Like, or as I like to say to my friends back here, like, why do people turn out the way they are? Like, and is there anything to do that if someone turns out in a sort of bad way, both dysfunctional for the self and others? What are the conditions and supportive conditions that one can create to put them on a better path? So while I was at Harvard, I also spent quite a lot of time with a guy called Dr. Michael Ferguson, who runs a center at Harvard Medical School. And between Harvard Medical School and Harvard Divinity School. And he is a neuroscientist, and he wanted to explore what is happening in the brain during mystical, ecstatic, and peak experiences, and even not so transcendent experiences, things like care, things like compassion, like what is actually happening on a neuroscience level. And, you know, questions like, is there a spot or a brain region that if you just, like, find, like, can you find God in the brain? You know, all these, like, funky scientific religious questions. So I did that for some time, with Dr. Ferguson, and partly because of what I was working on in California, which was sort of using technology itself to help humans move into higher states of mental, emotional, and spiritual flourishing. So not just the science of these states, but, like, can you actually use technologies and neurotechnologies to support people to have these insights in these states? And, you know, most people, when they hear me say that, they're like, oh, this is a dystopian Black Mirror episode. And I think to some degree it could be, right? If you had access to, you know, God on a button, or, like, a deep ecstatic experience by, like, clicking a button on a headset, like, that could get pretty dark pretty quick. But, you know, there's also a way in which I think we could yield such power quite skillfully, if we were able to, like, understand the science of the brain well enough. And I'm not making any, like, philosophical claims like God is in the brain, or, like, spiritual experiences are purely neurological, but the brain clearly plays a role, you know, in how people experience life and reality. And the crazy thing is, this is being studied at places like Harvard, and this is being really built, you know, in places like Silicon Valley. And, you know, I understand if people would be pretty skeptical about that, but it's a field, and it's definitely coming.
Yeah. What are the psychedelics that are most promising of actually helping people in, you know, if they've post traumatic stress disorder or just you know, depression in general?
So I believe that MDMA is being looked at for post-traumatic stress disorder. And I know in the US they're looking at that in veterans, US military veterans. psilocybin, which is the active ingredient in magic mushrooms, I know one of the main areas of research is treatment-resistant depression. I think those are the two that have been the most prominent in the press, at least. And I'm not too sure about where all the other ones stand. But I think I have a sort of like general model of, and it's not just mine, but like, why do these things work for mental illnesses?
Yes. Yeah.
Well, in some of the Johns Hopkins psilocybin studies, which is the active ingredient in mushrooms, like I said, the degree to which people healed was in large part proportionate to the degree to which they had a mystical experience under these, under the intake of this drug. So in other words, the more mystical experience the participants' trip was, the more likely they were to recover from their underlying mental ailments. So Adam Ghazali, who's a professor at UCSF, calls this like experiential medicine. Like, it's not just the manipulation of certain brain receptors like serotonin or 5-HT2A receptors. There's something about the experience that these people who take these things tend to have that seems to be intrinsically healing for their minds. And whether is that because they have access to meaning, to something sacred, I don't know. But I just think that's really interesting. Like, mysticism determines the degree to which one experiences something that's mystical determines the proportion to which they end up healing.
Yeah.
I don't know if they can replicate that in all studies, but that was definitely the Johns Hopkins one.
When you think about it in a really practical terms, I find that I'm amazed how simple sometimes solutions appear and also are, and other times same case and it doesn't work. Like, you know, I give you an example. Like I would have someone, you know, in a circle of friends that really shows signs of like very depressed, really can't get out of bed, can't do this. And you look at that and you see like, okay, you know, the mind is really not upbeat, but is this, whether it's the body or not, I don't know. And you know, they would put themselves on a regime of, you know, getting up earlier, using an infrared sauna, being in the sun a lot, doing actually much more exercise, eating a little bit healthier and so on. And having made maybe also some sort of counseling happening on the side. And it doesn't take much and they're back on the swing. And you know, the missing puzzle piece almost came in and the negative spiral stopped and it's the opposite. Mm. You know, for some it's actually religion. You know, religion is probably not as popular as it used to be, but for some it's like, as you said, like that, you find meaning, you find community, you know, you find a way of life and say like, okay, this is the path and it helps. And for other people, it seems to be, it can't pull them out. Like, you know, and of course I'm not a practitioner, so I wouldn't exactly know what that is about, but it strikes me as unfortunate. And then at the same time, also there's so much opportunities to probably offer people things that they can explore and that might really get them.
Yeah. Why do people remain stuck? I think that's the big question.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's probably, you know, 9 billion answers of like, how would that work? Because, you know, every human has their own complexity and I'm sure there's something that works for quite a few of them, but is it also something that will just, you know, not be enough? And so I'm quite excited about, you know, going into that field of psychedelics and just see like, look, you know, this is really strong. You know, this is really a mind altering thing. And maybe that is all it takes.
Maybe. Yeah. But I should caveat that with saying I think these things can actually make people a lot worse as well. And I've definitely know people in California and here who have experimented with these things and they've either provoked, revealed, or caused mental health difficulties. So I'd say, yeah, these things are promising, the science looks good, and you're playing with fire by exploring the recesses of your mind. I think there are safer ways. I think there's, I think there are safer ways to get there. So I think like a lot of the people who do these things, they're essentially trying to like get at trauma. And trauma defined as something like something that happens to us in the past that keeps us stuck or frozen in the present. And it amazes me to the degree to which one is able to access these latent or stored memories that are causing our pain in the present through deep containers or deep relationships that feel extremely safe. So I've done some work with a guy called Thomas Hubo, who's a teacher, a developmental trauma teacher, and an amazing man on an amazing field and group of people. And it's really about getting into the body, really being able to be with yourself in a safe way. And I think it can get people to a lot of the places that they try to get to kind of too quickly with some of these other paths.
What are, so is that related to taking any particular substances to alter your state, or is it sort of more like a meditation or nothing like that? Is it just actually by just accessing it through conversation and counseling?
Yeah. Great question. So it's both, is conversation plus embodiment plus safety. Yeah. Because embodiment, I think embodiment is the big thing. If we get into our bodies and feel our feelings and feel our sensations, this is what the field of like somatic experiencing and Peter Levine is like. It's, trauma or emotions will tend to reveal themselves if we are able to deeply be with our bodies safely over a prolonged stretch.
Yeah.
And, you know, sorry.
There you go.
No, like therapy can be good, but therapy, like a lot of the time, it's not embodied. It's just like retelling narratives and then like changing your meaning-making structures. It has to be coupled with the body. At least that's my current view. I might change my view in 10 years' time, but that's my, or next year, next week. I don't think I'm going to change my view next week on this because it's really profound.
Well, you know, my experience with this topic is so I've 5 kids and they're all homeschooled on the Steiner principle and Montessori principle. But, you know, the underlying idea when it comes to body and mind is that it's all about the body before you sort of turn 7, and you won't learn to read and write ideally before that. And there are certain things, like when you look at Steiner-inspired books, they often, especially for the younger ones, quite sort of milky, not quite sharp pictures in it. And there's a really particular reason for that, because the mind has not developed to the state. So, you want gently to become that, get that sharpness and that analytical. But what's much more important is that you really learn your body and that you're really in your body. And I've had a couple of a practitioner on this podcast, they would say like, look, you know, we're really, really good in thinking and we're really, really good in doing, but we're not being. And, you know, with devices like, you know, smartphones or whatever have you, like electronically sort of like being geared up, or even actually if you're in a city and you see all these ads, you don't daydream as such, you consume all the time. And so the embodiment is actually not happening, like that you really actually check in with your body. Was this good food? Was this bad food? Like, was this a conversation that was uplifting or not? And if you don't digest all these experiences, there comes a point that if you would let yourself be bored or dormant, it would come in a surge, because there has so much been. Like if my boss screams at me, but I try to numb it by be on social media just before I fall to bed, to sleep, fall asleep, so I haven't really thought about that, then wake up and the day starts again with social media, with, you know, like doing thing. And I think it's a really major problem in society, is that we use our brains too much. Like, I'm so guilty of that as well. I feel comfortable in there, but not necessarily be right.
Yeah. I mean, I'm putting my hand up not to speak, but to just say, I can preach this all I want, but I'm still pretty bad at this, Sebastian. Yeah, I think this is a really profound point. It sounds like a simple point, but there's a lot of profundity in it, which is the way we process or digest stuff is being with it And if you are encapsulated by technology, by distraction technologies, which is essentially what these things are, you lose those little micro moments of digestion. And that's one reason I think a lot of us are so stressed. It's not because the load is too much. It's because we're not processing the load as it happens, because we're distracting, like you said. I actually think this is a huge thing. Like, if we were just, it's huge. Before technology, you're just processing the stuff that happened. Whether you don't have the fancy trauma words for it, like processing. No. You just have boredom. You're just bored, right?
Yeah.
And you're bored and you feel really uncomfortable, but you can't do anything about it. And yet,
yes,
people back then seem to be, you know, even last century, you know, mental health issues seem to be much worse now. And everyone knows and feels it's something to do with technology. And, you know, people have different hypotheses. Is it, you know, is it the blue light? Is it the sort of like social validation? Or is it the fact that we can't digest?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. And the body-mind connection is so powerful and still understated. You know, like if you're in a fight and flight mode in your brain, and that is really simple. Like you live in a busy city, your body can't help it, but, you know, being super alert, like, you know, when I cross the street, I have to be careful. I have to check everyone around me whether there's any danger, because there's so many people that are unknown. So you really have to use this to actually scan sort of like, am I safe or not? And that really leads to the body not being in its normal rest and digest state, which is way less. Actually, that's a healing state anyway. But the opposite is really like it stops actually digesting, stops certain body functions if you're in fight and flight, and that moment it can't work properly, right?
Yeah. Well, so let's like wrap this back around with the start of our conversation, which is like, if your digestion is working really well, it probably means you can access rest and digest well, which probably means your parasympathetic activity is like quite good. And, you know, I think a lot of people who are struggling with bloating, for example, and they're looking to cut out the problematic foods, could do just as well resting, deepening, relaxing, getting into their bodies, and you'd probably get the same effect. Yeah. Cutting out a bad food or just peace. It's has a huge impact. Gut motility is very linked to the brain gut, which is very linked to the sort of limbic fight flight response.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And not discrediting people who have really, you know, have allergies and all the rest of it. I totally agree with you.
Sure.
And it's a trade-off, yeah. Isn't it? Because look, you know, we live in a time where probably it feels like we have so much freedom. We have access to a lot of different information. You know, we can be busy and learning or experiencing online or in real life so much more than ever before. You know, you can travel around the world, which is, if you think about it, like even 100 years ago, if someone says like, you want to go to America or whatever it might be, it's like, you know, do you want to go to, you know, the bottom of the world, like where I'm in Australia, that was just like, whoa, that's a crazy thought. I'm grateful that I even have seen images of that place, right? And, you know, 100 years further, this is just a thing like, oh, you know, I want to travel at least once a year. So society has changed so much. And I guess the body doesn't, you know, the evolution of a body takes so much longer. And I think that's just like, you can't override our biology, really. And that should be the clue in my mind to really see like, well, if I can't change how my body functions, like it doesn't have an on and off switch. It doesn't have like, hey, you should not take on any emotions because you're just a vehicle and my brain would deal with everything else. So just shut up. You know, you can't do that either. So the question is, how do you then actually accept that this is your limitation or a factor that can't be altered? So this is like the body needs nourishing and, you know, really specific things. If you accept that, then life should be wrapped around that as like, what does a human need to make sure they have, which might mean for you, two hours of social media max or 20 minutes per day, you know, whatever it is. Or it's really like the sleep that this body, this vehicle needs for you is just at the moment non-negotiable. Like you cannot work for longer than 5 p.m. or 7 p.m. And then, you know, you really have to get off the screen for some hours before you, whatever it is. I don't know. Do you have a view on that? Like it just came to my mind that's like, you can't fight it because otherwise you will cause problems.
Yeah. So what do you mean? You can't fight the, like, the technology stuff. You just have to.
Or opposite. Like you can't fight that your biology is what it is. Like you,
oh,
you
I
have
see.
To yeah, acknowledge yeah, yeah. Yeah. That you have, you know, physical limitations that come from the body, and you have to create an environment and a rhythm around you that allows this body to still function very well.
Yeah. I think this is this whole like Silicon Valley versus the rest of the world's mentality, which is we have limitations of biology, but we can transcend them through tech, or we can transcend them through gene therapies. And, you know, I'm not closed to that view. Like there might be some sort of gene therapy that, you know,
yeah.
has an impact on, you know, X aging marker, like telomeres, and suddenly you're living longer.
Sure.
So like, I think that's definitely an open possibility that we can extend these limits. But what I would caution, I'm saying, I think that sometimes we get a bit of ahead of ourselves, and this is speaking from someone who's worked in these types of fields, that we don't really understand how the body works. We have no freaking idea how life works. And then to think that we're just going to mess with it by trying to increase our limits rather than live harmoniously with them, it's scary. I mean, it will be done, but there's going to be a lot of problems along the way, because I just don't think we do know what things do. We don't understand the body's a complex system. It's not just a machine.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's fascinating how this came about, because if you think about just a few, well, even if I think about my parents, there were social norms and structures that just held certain things in place. You know, there were even, there's a norm of, like, you know, what you would normally bring to a party, to your gathering, you know, and they're just certain structures that somehow evolved, that humans evolved. And, you know, I'm sure like the 70s when they were sort of like younger, that there wasn't the reason all. If you go another 100 years back, there were also certain structures. But I think that they also can help a lot. Like I was talking to someone from India recently, and we were talking about, you know, how lonely it can be in the Western world, because you don't have the same amount of people around you. And so you would say, like, here you need a psychologist. Over there, I have so many aunties, uncles, and relatives that I can talk to. And you could say, like, well, you know, that this is not professional counseling. But there's certainly social structures that have broken away, and it feels like an experiment, what we're doing right now, which is basically chucking everything out and saying, like, no good religion, no good all these habits. Like, I want to do exactly this, and tech will help me to have still a balanced body, mind, and spirit.
Yeah. And I think the thing is, like, throwing out religion is like, we can try. But that religious impulse in the psyche that's evolved over thousands of years doesn't get thrown out. It just gets, like, obfuscated or, like, directed into something else, you know?
Talk to me a little bit about that.
So even, like, certain political movements now.
Yes.
Like, people think that they're supporting a political party. But if you actually listen to the language, like, savior, end of the world, us versus them, like perfection embodied in this archetype of a politician, and like he or she can do no wrong. Like a lot of these are very like religious instincts. They're not rational instincts. They're like my tribe for some like better future against the bad tribe. So what I'm trying to say there is, like, sometimes we think we're engaging rationally and secularly in the world when all we're doing is we're behaving like primitively and religiously in the world, but with like a rational veneer to it. Oh, it's about politics. Oh, well, really? Like what? What is the biology that's driving that? And even like some of these things, like we're bringing it back to health, like long periods of fasting and like long periods of like self-punishment through exercise. Some of these have like a religious feel to them, you know? It's like, punish myself, otherwise I'm not worthy. Yeah. That's religious.
Yeah.
That's religious. Yeah.
So what do you think are the possibilities for the future? Like, you know, that there's a lot of understanding, there's a lot of research, there's a lot of possibilities of what can do. If you think about the outcomes for, I guess, humanity going forward, like, you know, what would be the worst, what would be the best scenario that we could expect? I don't know what the likelihood of either is, but, you know, if you look at it, like, what's a good and what's a bad outcome out of all of this?
Are you talking health-wise, or are you speaking more broadly, Sebastian?
More broadly, yeah, because I believe, you know, like, health is part of, yeah, of the, yeah, so I would just more, where will we end up? Because that's what I often question is, like, do we have the solutions now? Are we good now? Or, you know, or does it go actually the other way?
Okay, so I'm going to give you my, like, pessimist hat on for a bit, and then I'll put my optimist hat on, okay? I'll start with the pessimist and then leave you on a bright note.
This has nothing to do with that you're Scottish, right? That you start
This is, if I was Scottish, I wouldn't end with the optimist. I'd just be pessimist the whole way through. So I think what the world has not woken up to is the fact that the game has changed substantially because of technology. And there's a guy called Daniel Schmachtenberger who speaks very eloquently about this. And he basically expresses how you should think about technology as power. As humanity grew, it grew from, you know, using power against others in an asymmetric way in order to gain, you know, dominance and territory. And that was done through things like rocks and then sword and then bows and arrows and then swords and then guns and then cannons and then guns and then guns and then tanks and tanks. And then you come all the way up to the, you know, 1945. And then sure enough, this power game turned into nuclear bombs. And so what you see there through evolution, there's this like evolution of the power that we can impose upon the world and against each other. So humanity has become exponentially more powerful. But that's been okay because, you know, there's only a handful of nuclear states and, you know, nobody wants to use nukes on each other because there's going to be like it's a negative sum game. Both parties lose or all parties lose. But what's changed now with the invention of artificial intelligence, drones, robotics, synthetic biology, we can basically use that exponential power, but not just at a state level. It's very cheap to create a drone. It's very easy to use CRISPR gene editing technologies to maybe make a synthetic biology weapon against a particular race. Like, when I say it's very easy, it's easier than creating a nuke. And so, to your point around inaccessible, so decentralized, democratized, accessible, exponential power. And if countries keep playing or keep different groups keep playing these like game theory dynamics, if I win, you lose, then eventually the power is going to get too much, too distributed, and it's just going to be, and so this is what Daniel says. He says like exponential power in a win-lose environment self-terminates eventually. You can't keep building more power, spreading that power across more and more non-state actors before the whole thing blows up. And I think this is one of the worries that we're seeing now with like Iran and Israel. And everyone's like, you know, you got to retaliate. And then the other party says, yeah, you need to retaliate. But you're retaliating not with guns versus guns anymore. You're retaliating with exponential tech. So that's my pessimist view, is that I don't know if humanity has the incentive structures or the wisdom to deal with this. So I don't know how we get out of that. And then on a better day, I would say something like evolution seems to present us with completely and utterly inescapable problems. And it is through those like deep pressure moments in evolution, both of culture and biology, that emergence seems to occur. So I don't think we know the answers to what's going to happen, but I think the cosmos is long enough and wise enough to know or to have demonstrated that there does seem to be a movement towards consciousness and complexity. And I don't think that would just end forever.
I think you can trust that, right? If I think about the rise and fall of societies, it doesn't mean that they're completely gone. All of the knowledge and the wisdom that came out of that has gone away anyway. So conflict, you know, is not the end of it. And I believe, like, on Earth at least, there are seasons of all of these things, right? Like, you know, you get, you know, to the spring, a new idea, a new movement. You can feel overall society has moved more into this. Then, you know, it becomes summer, you celebrate it, whatever. And then it slowly slows down. And an autumn phase, whether that's a phase of 1 year or 5 years or like 50 years, you know, you can look at different cycles and it seems to operate like that. And it would make sense because often you can see in social dynamics and that it mimics nature. You can find nature patterns like that, you know, and then you go a winter where nothing happens and it seems like, wow, these are the dark ages, and then it starts again. But yeah, I would agree with you. Like, you know, this conflict actually can create, you know, new solutions. And that's normally what it is like. You know, you have contrast to actually find an insight. The deepest insights normally are in the deepest despair. Unfortunately, it seems to work that way for humans, at least for me. Certainly, yeah, it's a different experience when in dire strait to then have a learning. But if I think about the solution, like one possible solution of something like that is, I guess, if you have people that are happy and satisfied, they will probably less likely be that irritated that if they end up in government or in a powerful position to actually say, I want to press the red button, or I want to, you know, use arms against someone else and so on. So I think one solution could really be is like, on an individual level, what tools are we given or give each other to become more balanced, to be actually satisfied with what we have? See, what I found is that I have a lot of wants, I have a lot of goals and all of that. And then I look at myself and like, if I would put it back to basics, like, you know, and be really happy in relationship with the family, with friends, these wants often go away. Like, you know, and if I feel healthy, then I'm, you know, more joyous and want to play at the beach rather than actually sort of like have this particular drive. And I think that's where the danger also lies. If we completely forget about that and just focus on our, you know, really rational mind, exclude the heart of our decisions, we end up in something that is unchecked.
Mm.
Want to go further. My ego really wants to manipulate this DNA at no cost, because my, you know, my ego really wants to be on this paper or wants to be in the public. It's like I've invented something that I know is not the right thing to go to, or, you know, I don't know if you see, like, you know, whether I'm not really eloquent in saying that, but, you know, I feel often when the heart is not involved and a decent amount of ethics and values and self-reflection, people's doing is not necessarily the best for humanity.
Yeah, I think inner change is a necessary but not sufficient condition to stop something pretty bad from happening. And when I say inner change, like, that's both like people like moving into like more peaceful states of mind, you know. If everyone, you know, there's this mm-hmm. whole thing, like, if everybody meditated, there'd be world peace. Like, that's kind of like not true, but it's also kind of like true. You know, and then there's, you know, if political leaders all worked on their childhood trauma, like, would they want to lash out in the same way? Probably not. You know, if someone feels happy and healthy, they're more likely to be, you know, better to their loved ones in their community. You know, I know when I'm stressed, I'm a bit of a douchebag to the people I love. So, you know, scale that up with exponential power in a political position and you're stressed as hell and you've not so, you know, looked at your stuff, you're going to be a douchebag, but with a lot more power. But why I say it's necessary and not sufficient is, I think I had the viewpoint that interchange was like enough, but, you know, there's always going to be these people who will cheat that. You know, if you have like bunch of psychopaths in the room and they see everyone else getting softer and more harmonious and peaceful, and they can then assert asymmetric power on those people and then get the positions in the hierarchy. So it's both. It's there needs to be like some deep shifts that I'm not smart enough to think about, and there needs to be the inner stuff, for sure. It's both, and I'm always caught between the two. Do I focus on interchange or do I focus on outer change?
Have you ever been exposed to the HeartMath Institute's work out there? Right.
Yeah.
So yeah, you know, just for some of them that might have not heard about it, it's really the principle behind it, and that's Princeton University, and they have a department, you know, called the HeartMath Institute, and they looked into, is there anything about, you know, meditating on peace that really can be measured as an effect on society in a particular area? And that was done in war situations, sort of in the Middle East, where people meditated at a particular time on peace and wanted to see, does it make a difference in terms of casualties, in terms of numbers of attacks and so on? And they found a really positive response to when people meditated on that. And not only that, it was double blind. And from there, they kicked off a lot of meditation experiments. And the original study, I think, included 50 different cities in the US. And they would look at admissions to hospitals, crime in general, call-outs for police, and so on. And there's a significant change when people start to meditate. And they also looked at, like, how many people do have to meditate? And it's like the square root of 1% of the population of a particular area. It's magical to me. Like, is that, how can people's behavior be influenced by other people just meditating on peace? But it's really, when you look from a scientific point of view, it's really conclusive. And that gives me hope that, like, there's overall that the good will prevail for whatever reason. And maybe this is because this is actually like a positive universe. I have no idea. I'm not, you know, never looked into this too deeply scientifically, but I do see certain positive things that seem to be more powerful than the negative.
Yeah. If I don't know about this, the study on meditation and peace. I do know HeartMath, but I don't know that there's people like Rupert Sheldrake who speaks about morphic fields. Have you heard of him, Sebastian?
I have heard his name, but I don't know his work.
Yeah. I mean, as the idea is that memory isn't stored in space, but it's stored in time. It's the idea that certain places, certain communities, they actually hold collective memory. He thinks that, like, the field, he called them fields, morphic fields, can be charged with certain thought forms. And, you know, he was a Cambridge biologist. He was pretty legit in the old academic world. He's out there for some people now, but if people are interested in learning about how the mind might influence the fields, there are some people trying to have a go at this, like, scientifically.
Well, you know, phantom DNA is a thing, isn't it? Like, you know, there was this experiment, and I'm sure that it has been replicated many times, is that people would work on DNA at a particular place in the lab, and then so doing certain tests, and then the DNA has moved away. But up to 30 days after, you could actually still detect the same DNA without being it there. There are just certain things that, I don't know whether science has moved on. That's about 10 years ago that I looked into that a little bit more. But there's certainly magical things where you say, like, there's more to it. There's so much more to it, to the material world, well, and beyond the material world that we don't understand, but there could really be also a solution.
Yeah, the mind matter phenomenon is interesting. There's also an institute in California called the Institute of Noetic Sciences, and they do these experiments to look at, you know, how the mind might affect matter. I just don't think we know. You know, I think it's because we just don't understand our physics well enough or our metaphysics well enough. But I wouldn't rule it out to say that there is obviously a connection between consciousness and matter, and we know that through quantum experiments and double slit and these like famous experiments where when you look at something, if you look at the outcome of a light being a particular wave is contingent upon a conscious observer. So we know that, you know, it's just known as a spooky result from quantum stuff. But even that, just, you know, the fact that that exists shows that there could be some mind matter interaction at a more macro level, but we just don't know. And I'm always very reticent to say definitively, because I think the problem with a lot of people in this space, and when we start getting into like making these claims, is like people can get really dogmatic about you know, this is how it works, you know, and you got your like, you know, spiritual teachers saying, this is how reality works. And you're like, really? How do you know? Like, how do you know? Why should I trust you?
So you have started a wellness center in the area that you are in now. What was the motivation for that? Because like, you know, this sounds like a random question after all we talked about, but you know, of course you might have seen like, you know, I feel a calling and a solution here that certainly can, you know, can help part of the issue or all of it.
Yeah, definitely not all of it, but part of it. Yeah. So building a high-tech healing space, we're calling it Holon. And Holon is a term from philosophy of science, which means like part whole. So standard medicine looks into the parts of the body through diagnostics and like reductively goes down into the smallest pieces. And then sort of more holistic medicine looks at the whole person, the mind-body relationships, environment. Holon basically means we do both. So basically at Holon, we have 8 different healing technologies, including one of yours, Sebastian, clear light, sauna, like standard. We have an ice bath, we have a hyperbaric oxygen chamber, we have PEMF, compression boots, red light therapy, red light for the brain. And then we also have yoga, breathwork, meditation classes. But not only that, we also offer sort of advanced blood testing that I was speaking to at the start, these things like Nutrabell and toxin testing for things like heavy metals and mold and gut health. So yeah, we're basically like a full service wellness center with technologies, with yoga, breathwork, meditation, and with a sort of functional medicine capacity too, to allow you to test for things that your standard doctor wouldn't allow you to test for. And one of the reasons that I'm doing this, there are several reasons, is a lot of people are not well and standard medicine does not seem to be able to help them. And I felt like building a space where people could access these resources, I could have really done with that when I had some of my own chronic health issues. I could have really benefited from a space like this. So the idea is people come, they heal, they relax, they get into a parasympathetic rest and digest mode, and they leave empowered with the sort of data and information to know how to actually apply these things back at home.
It's really awesome. It's also a teaching facility in that way, yes?
Boom, I love you say that. Yeah, we're a physical space, but also an education space, yeah. And I didn't prime you to say that. I love how you picked that up, yeah.
But it sounds like that. And having talked to you, like, there's certainly, I can see that you would say, like, you know, you don't have, like, 1 hour per day where you do the right thing and then 23 hours, you do whatever. It sounds like, you know, your philosophy is more like, you know, just do the right thing all the time that actually works for you. And that seems like you offer a lot of different modalities, and you probably say, look, some people pick this, some people say this is the all space, and whatever it is where their journey starts or where that leads it to.
Totally, yeah. We're not launched yet, but I'm excited to exactly put this all together for people. And and I think that's the point around the education space is interesting, because if people don't have the knowledge, you know how you said near the start of our conversation, why do some people like, and I'm paraphrasing, like remain stuck and they go in this downward cycle after they've been in an upward cycle. Like some of it is emotional. Like I think there's some developmental stuff probably happening there, but some of it is also just knowledge. Like do that many people know about circadian rhythm setting? You know, people like might do. Do they know about, you know, whether or not to do aerobic exercise or anaerobic exercise? Like a lot of it is knowledge. Do they know about toxins? Yeah. Do they know that if you go into a sauna, like you might actually be helping yourself get rid of all those bloody microplastics you just ingested from the bottled water you just had, you know?
Yeah. So true.
They got in. Yeah.
Yeah. I found it scary that I don't know if you know the movie Memento. I'm citing that at the moment a lot, because what happens to me is like, I used to have a solution for this. I used to have a mind hack that, you know, sort of put me in a positive space. And it just seems sometimes you just forget the solutions and you start afresh again. Maybe it's a good thing. Maybe it's a human thing, but you know, it's certainly, oh man, never ending.
Yeah. I always come back to that. I'm like, man, I knew this 7 years ago. Why am I like relearning this now?
Yeah. And it is back to the basics. I think that's, you know, like we like, you know, I think it's a human tendency to like the shiny stuff, the new stuff, and saying, oh, you know, this is it. But I think what gets forgotten, and I'm thinking about a couple of mentors of mine, like they come to mind that say like, yes, but you still do the basics. Like even a billionaire will do still the basics of what's required for business. Like there's still building blocks that you can't ignore afterwards. Like you can't just meditate but not eat forever. Like most people wouldn't be able to do that. You know, like some breatharians exist, and you know, but that's a really specific way of living. And other than that, it's like you will have to look at the full spectrum and balance it nicely out for you. So Josh, if people want to learn more about you and the center, where would they go?
So to learn more about Holon, if you are in Glasgow, Scotland, or anywhere in the UK, you can go to Holon, holon.co.uk. And then you can find me just by Googling my name, Joshua Fields. And Glasgow or Joshua Fields consciousness. Because if you just Google Joshua Fields, you get this famous author, who I am not him, unfortunately. So you have to follow it with a suffix. So holon.co.uk, Joshua Fields Consciousness, or Joshua Fields Substack.
Yeah.
And I've also got some stuff on YouTube talking about sort of the future of mental health technologies, the future of some of the stuff we spoke about too. So.
Yeah, very cool. Just a slightly selfish question. Any particular books that you recommend, like that really blew your mind recently, or in general, are the typical go-tos that you know you can recommend when people who are interested in anything that we talked about? I know you mentioned so many authors, which I really love. I to me that's so valuable because that's, you know, avenues to explore. But maybe something comes to mind.
Yeah. So in the sort of world-changing stuff, as I mentioned, Daniel Schmachtenberger, he's fantastic. In the health domain, I actually have learned a lot from a guy called Grimhood on Twitter. His name's Grimhood, and he's got a Patreon. He's not,
how do you spell
it? Grimhood. And he's known as like the magnesium daddy on Twitter. And there's a joke on Twitter that if someone really cannot solve a health issue, like Grimhood is like the last guy you go to. Like he's like the guy who knows how to solve things that nobody else can solve. The person who comes to mind. I don't have any like special books at the top of my head. Like I'd recommend people look up Grimhood. He's got, you know, he's quite well known on Twitter, and he's got a great Patreon page. And his principles are pretty basic, you know, circadian rhythm setting, you know, like good food, good diet. But then he's also very knowledgeable about how to heal from very, very, supposed very, very hard conditions to heal from. And he helped me. I did a coaching session with him. He was really good.
Oh, amazing. Thank you. Thanks for that's awesome. Yeah. Awesome. Well, Geoff, thank you so much for spending more than an hour with me and the audience and talk about everything health and life, really. Really appreciate your time. Real privilege to dive so deep into some of the sort of more fringe topics as well. I think there could be avenues that eventually become, you know, common knowledge. Who knows?
Yeah, the fringe becomes the mainstream. You know, thanks for your time, Sebastian. Yeah, I enjoyed this.
Terrific.
We hope you got a lot out of today's inspiring conversation. Please share this episode with someone you know needs to hear it, whether they are a seasoned health expert or just beginning their wellness journey. These stories of remarkable transformation, success, and valuable insights will certainly help empower more people. Until next time, have the best life ever.